Hello, this is Daryl Warr for June 2023. I'm going to do another retrospective, for this time for episode 17 in the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows. Maintaining contact with pen friends and listeners in the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows has really benefited us all in the last year or half year. All of us aren't getting closer, but we're slowly recognizing that a small group is better. I was on the phone with a longtime listener within the last couple weeks and letting her know that I'm happy to take that step back. I just came forward to find out what the problem was when I discovered it in 2013 of why people weren't chatting the narrative. And then it took me forever to figure out chatting the narrative. The words were the important component in doing that. And I'm more than happy to just have us, presumably 25 overall, in between 5 and 25, give or take what is good for people as far as like the schedule they have and what times they've got to focus on pit episodes. But yeah, happy to just go back to small group. And that's why the Antifine stuff is not going to make sense, because there's no reason to be threatened or offended or whatever if you're going out of your way to stalk someone, to see that someone means you no harm. The people are just looking for their people, or that person is looking for her person or set of people, and there's no real need to go out of one's way to stalk or harass, or, you know, it's empty. And of course, the scariest part that I've been discussing with friends and companions on this journey is that the anti-fan phenomenon, a lot of it is coming from the attention thieves, you know, the people who are in your pocket 24/7, doing way more than I could ever do with my tape recorder or my film camera, just a more potent version of recording you, and you're paying, like, approximately $60 a month for this privilege? So that they can scrape your data and figure out your idiosyncrasies and figure out what you were going to pay attention to before you do. And yeah, there's some perks to that. But then, well, we've seen the results, haven't we? So, yeah, as I've noticed the stats change, as I've discussed the anti-fan, just the words, and then potential anti-fans have to go and seek out what anti-fan means. Even had a friend on the phone ask, what does that mean? And it's like, well, you've sent me some stuff on the topic, but whoever it was wasn't saying that word. But that's what the topic was, is this phenomenon where your attention is stolen and you get very angry about something or about someone or about a group of someone's. And then they throw an advertisement in there. That's the whole purpose, is to sell the advertisement and get the revenue for that. Not even caring about the repercussions of what it's doing to your psyche or anyone else's. And so it's not mustache trolling evil. It is business model stuff. They're not really, you know, I've made this joke to a friend on the phone too, where I said, it's like a Negaverse plot, except they're not giggling happily over it. We want your energy. They're just must maximize shareholder value. Like, it's just very monotone. It's not mustache twirling evil or giggly evil. It's a Negaverse plot, but it's a very deadened one. It's a very monotone one. And we get angry at what we're responding to, but they're just like, day at the office. It's not. And a lot of the people involved in this stuff, they quit their jobs. They're not happy with the situation either. The design, as I've said a few podcasts ago, it's the design that is the flaw. It is not villains. It is the design of the whole thing. But yeah, if you had some sort of machine that was built a certain way, you're not going to sit there getting angry at the machine for twirling its mustache at you. You're going to be either fix the machine or build a new one. And that is the situation we are at. And so I've told companions on this journey, you know, I'm happy to go back to. I found out what the problem was. It took a long time. I had to be involved in it. Like I said, in the, I think it was the 2023 February show, I was in the snake pit with everyone. And yeah, I think that's going to be the saddest thing that anti-fans will have to face, is that Daryl Warr was not out to get you. It was other people. Daryl Warr was trying to find her people for this project. The people who were out to get you and who got you made you angry about all sorts of things and all sorts of people. And it was not really your choice. It was just preying on your vulnerabilities. That's not nice, and I don't agree with it, and it's not my fault, but I do apologize, because it's not pretty. It makes me... But then again, I got angry because I got involved, and then as I slowly looked over, you know, who is talking about this? Back in 2017, who is talking about this? And, you know, Center for Humane Technology came up. Other people came up too. There are a lot of people connected to them and to the social dilemma, all that stuff. But I was positive there was something wrong because I already did the surveillance stuff in my own lifetime. So I recognized people have distinctly changed. It is not just, oh, these bad eggs, you know, random bad eggs or this bad person or whatever. No, it's not. It wasn't like that. There was something bigger going on, and we've slowly unraveled what that bigger thing was. So, that's why I say, if you were an anti-fan, you probably want to move on from the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows, because it's probably soaked up too much of your life. If you had an interest in it, you could maybe accept what happened and become a fan rather than an anti-fan, but I would say that might take too long, and you might want to just go to a different hobby, go to something else that interests you. Whereas the people who got in touch with me directly, they did agree with me a lot of times. Yeah, there's something wrong. And they maintained there's something wrong most of the time. Sometimes they would react to certain stories I was telling them, like, oh, those terrible people. No, 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 we're going deeper. We're going deeper. You know, this person or those people began nice. But as my story with that, you know, group or person unfolds, you can see there's... The Ringmaster's Whip is happening. It's not that he or she is bad. It's that there's a manipulation going on. And it's not good. And you can't blame the person for that. They do still become accountable. That's the current system that we have. But, yeah. It's, something's not right. And we're all, I think, working on trying to make it right again. Not that it was all that great before, but... We know a whole lot more. So let us get to episode 17 in the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows, which is A Bioexorcist Comes to Colin Wood. So, of course, the first scene is Milgen and Hecubus, our hosts from the Kids in the Hall. And Milgen is trying to hurry things up because there's always showy rapture with Hecubus when they're introduced. And that goes back to the original Kids in the Hall. There was a lot of showy rapture for Hecubus to the point where I remember Kevin MacDonald was... People would call him the Hecubus guy, and he'd get very irritated thinking, I'm not Hecubus, I'm Sir Simon Milgen. Those interviews where he talks about that, that's how I, like, slowly in doing these roles came to really adore Kevin MacDonald. Just, yeah, I know, because... Even I, doing fan work and going through the motions of being both characters, there was a lot of call for more Hecubus over time. And I was like, I know how Kevin MacDonald feels now. It's like, you know, we all love Dave Foley, but again, he's the cute guy. And he is known as the cute guy. So Hecubus, it's very similar. It gets a little exasperating, so... The showy rapture, Milgen is trying to skip it in the beginning of episode 17, A Bioexorcist Comes to Collinwood. And then it's great, you know, it's like as my pen pal said, you know, how just rapturous Milgen gets over Angelique Evangelique. And talking about Our Lady Evangelique, short for Vampire Angelique, saying a certain bioexorcist name 3 times, and she has been sucked into the drawing room by her enemy, who may at one time have been her lover. That's the idea. Because she gets around, and Beetlejuice also gets around. But Hecubus was saying those lines. And, of course, Milgen, hark, has everyone gotten to her ahead of me? And somebody had something great to say about, well, yeah, she a lot of people have gotten to her ahead of Milgen. And then he says, Succubus of Satan, harlot of the devil, my sweet evil Vangelique. Sounds a bit Vulcan, that name. And then Hecubus asks, as in the god of war, master, because that's more or less where the Vulcan name comes from, is the god of war from mythology. And Milgen says, no, it sounds Vulcan, meaning Vangelique, the name, sounds Vulcan, as in. And then he says, oh, let's not drag that fandom into this thing. Lots of responses from my, you know, handful of people, a fair amount, and one was like, oh, go ahead, drag Star Trek into it. There's a lot of call for it. Or if anyone could drag Star Trek into it, it would be you, Daryl. I really loved that one. And I've thought about it, and I just never really got very far with it. I mean, The Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows also is inspired partly by Star Trek: The Next Perpetration, which was focused on the next generation Star Trek, but that duo or trio of writers put together something that encompassed the original cast as well, here and there, and all these other things. I mean, when we talk about like non-canon pairings, one of my favorites in humor, big humor, is Dr. Crusher and Dr. Smith from Lost in Space. Like, Dr. Crusher from that Star Trek. I mean, it was just hilarious. It was hilarious. It wasn't something that I got enraptured over, but it was hilarious. So, yeah, when they say drag Star Trek, I mean, The Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows is actually a little, quite a bit inspired by a Star Trek fan work, because they wrote it as a radio play, and that means that you could like, squish so much more in. Definitely, and it was one of my cousins was the introducer of that, so I hope he is still smiling about that influence. Yeah, and I, not now, but a few episodes ahead, we will have gone beyond the number of episodes Star Trek The Next Perpetration had. I didn't have time to be very proud, but over the years, recognizing that, I am very proud to have exceeded the number of episodes that The Pit has more than Star Trek The Next Perpetration. But I tried to get a hold of him and say, hey, you could have done this and this and this, and I would look forward to it. Let's see. I mentioned that, I think, in the 10th anniversary show for The Pit. And that was the other thing. Milligan is, after the Star Trek thing, says, all right, Sullivan or Weinberger, Bailey, Lupatkin, move it. We need the opening credits right quick. And that was me grabbing from the credits and trying to discern who in Dark Shadows was involved in putting the credits up or any of the other technical aspects to get the show going back in the day. So I just grabbed all those names and had Milligan try to figure out, like, I'm not sure who I'm talking to, but somebody involved has to get these credits up very quick so we can just get on with the story. And then the fight, you know, I've only written, this is like probably the second battle scene I've ever written. I did one in prose, and that was my vampire novels, and it was with a supernatural creature. Yeah, that was difficult too. And this is, you know, in radio drama, so this is like the second one that I've tried to figure out. And of course, the music helps a lot, the characters help a lot, trying to figure out what on earth the bioexorcist and Angelique, vampire Angelique, I mean, how are they going to go at each other? With Beetlejuice, it's easier to imagine. With Angelique, it's harder to try and figure out, well, what kind of vampire magic does she have? Which is a term I coined not too long ago. My husband was asking in a later episode how Lily Munster took the seaweed off of Bill Malloy on the ship, and I said, vampire magic. And I hadn't even thought about it, labeling it as that. So, yeah, I mean, and we know there's vampire magic. It's in a lot of vampire stories. There's just vampire voodoo, voodoo, woo-woo. So I'm not sure. I mean, I gave her one thing that was really awesome that I remember Helena liked, which was like she breathed fire at Beetlejuice in this fight scene. And I still think one of the things that Beetlejuice did was that was light a cigarette. But I didn't really put it anywhere. And nobody seemed to care whether or not I wrote any kind of prose version of this, so I never got around to it. And Beetlejuice claims he's just passing through, but he's getting his payback. And that is where, in my mind's eye, you slowly go between the foyer and the drawing room wall to get a sequence of the battle scene and what everybody else is talking about, Barnabas and Maggie, then David, then Roger, that kind of thing. So you're always slowly going back and forth in your imagination, or at least in mine. And then it gets kind of scary because Maggie, as Josette, you know, she's got these memories and kind of ghost memories. And again, you know, you feel bad for Barnabas. He was doing what he was told. He feels confident in it. There seems to be a lot of consensus, but then his sweetheart, Maggie, reincarnation of Josette, is not happy and not really mad at him per se, but just like, WTF is going on? And he's doing what he was told. And she's asking him, don't you know how dangerous summoning a bioexorcist is? She's got otherworld experience, so she knows that. Barnabas like, I haven't had any of that which you describe. I've been locked away for over 170 years. So, yeah, he doesn't know. So this kind of goes back to what we had in our last retrospective where my pen pal was saying that, yeah, she would be the Time Lord explaining things to Barnabas. Just, and we have it right here in episode 17. She's explaining things to him. He's taking the initiative. He needs to take the initiative. He's Barnabas Collins, for heaven's sake. But the fight continues in the drawing room, and it's almost like they're just pummeling each other in some ways, but I also see a bit of it as the bioexorcist becomes that snake creature that he was in the film. And so crashing punches, and then David, and so there's a lot of trivia in this where we're going back to first year, and we're going back to second year of Dark Shadows, but also the pit. So David is running down the stairs, is that green thing in the kitchen again, which is going back to episode one. It was Slimer from the Ghostbusters. But at the same time, David's running up the stairs. I'm going upstairs for my stamp collection. Roger comes across the hall. He's not in the best of moods. Nobody's in the best of mood. Oh, and Oshin was suggesting that the drawing room decanters are hardly at my disposal, so I can't relieve my current anxiety with a drink. But he knows what's going on. So that the decanters thing, that was Oshin's suggestion that I used. And I'd been thinking about this for so long. You know, I had a lot of this in my mind in 2013. That's why the Bill Malloy stuff at the end is so rushed. It's just squished in. But I wanted to get the agreement from a lot of people. Would the Collins have maybe had insurance from Lloyd's of London? A lot of folks do. So he goes, he's like, I'm going to the study to save our insurance papers from Lloyd's of London, you daft fools. And he doesn't really feel Maggie and Barnabas are daft fools. He's just in the height of the moment. But then, of course, as the Beetlejuice theme music keeps on going and there's all these explosions and crescendo of noise, Barnabas wonders, good grief, can his relationship with her, meaning Beetlejuice, have been worse than mine? And it's like, oh, I think so. I think it could have been worse. Then at some point we do address, you know, BJ asks Angelique, you can't even say my name, can ya? Too scared or cursed, whichever, all I know is it makes me happy. And I knew I had to address that at some point. And that was how I addressed it. There's something going on with her internally where she can't say the name because she knows that could get her out of it very quickly. If she recognized at the end of episode 16, Barnabas saying it was going to get her into trouble. Well, you could just say his name 3 times, get yourself out of trouble, but there's something going on with that. She's either cursed about it or scared about it, so she can't do anything. She just has to try to fight him off and lose. And we go back to some of the stuff, like apparently some sort of otherworldly marriage would have gotten Beetlejuice out of the issue, and that's what we see in the Beetlejuice film, and that's why he's trying to marry Lydia, is to try and get him out of whatever he's stuck in. I don't know how the rules work, but he says he doesn't, you know, it's not his rules. So I figured that would just drop that in there, that that was the issue. So there's a lot of stuff taken from the film. And also this bit grabbed from the Dark Shadows 2012 film, because I figure with the Beetlejuice film, we're also, that's again, going back to Tim Burton and giving an applaud to his crews over the years, you know, because it's not just one guy, it's a crew of people, a lot of people involved. But with the battle of the Bioexorcist and Evangelique, I take stuff from the 2012 film because I figured it's just as well. This is a mixture of Dark Shadows and Tim Burton, Beetlejuice and all that, so there's stuff directly taken. But from the film, it was Barnabas versus Angelique, and this is, you know, she's using the Barnabas lines, I command you to desist. And Beetlejuice is the one who says, oh yeah, you command, you make me sick. And rather than Angelique projectile vomiting on Barnabas, it's a Beetlejuice projectile vomiting on Angelique, but it's like the old 60s versions. So, yeah, like, I figure a lot of people would figure that out. And there was a Jonah suggestion, something that was more from a Michael Keaton film, Come On, You Big Stupid Worm. You want to get nuts, let's get nuts. But also, oh, look, Beetle's chewing, and that was also inspired from the Dark Shadows 2012 film, because when Angelique projectile vomited in that film, there were beetles. Like, you look down, or whoever the character was looked down, there were beetles in the vomit. So it was like, oh, that's like, that to me, that's a nod to Beetlejuice, because he eats bugs. He eats beetles. Angelique, when I first saw you, I hated you. Beetlejuice says, which is why you were hot for me, weren't you? Weren't you? And want a piece of me, come on, baby, go for it. And that she does the fiery breath. And I remember Helena being pretty tripped out by that. Like, oh, she's got some fire breath. I'm like, yeah, it's pretty cool. And again, with the fire breath, I always think that's him. He'd just light a cigarette on it. He wouldn't be worried about it. And then as we go through, you know, he says easily eliminated. You hear a lot of sound effects, a lot of battle stuff. But I had to pull something from The Lost Boys. One thing I never could stomach about Collinsport, all the damn vampires. And I remember sharing that online somewhere, and somebody saying, no, that's The Lost Boys. And I'm like, that means, since I got that, it wasn't really an argument, it was just sort of a reaction. I was like, well, now that I've gotten that reaction, I think I'm definitely including the line. It just set me off. I was like, yeah, I know it's the Lost Boys. That's why I'm adding it. You know, I'm including tons of stuff here. Then the happier music afterward, and Barnabas realized, okay, I can't say Beetlejuice, so I'll call him Mr. Juice. And he says, not quite my name, but that works. And yeah, that was the other really neat thing that I'd like to share, is I was racking my brain and trying to figure out, and I asked my husband, how would Barnabas Collins pronounce the name Beetlejuice? And he had the best idea. He said, well, how would the book voice of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy pronounce it? He would probably pronounce it the same way. And I was like, that's right. So I'd listened to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the radio drama, or you know, whoever it was, Peter Jones, I think his name is, the voice of the book in the miniseries or the radio drama. And so I just sort of adapted and tried to do the Barnabas voice, that pronunciation. That was the goal that my husband offered and that I used. Anyway, yeah, Beetlejuice does explain how he did it. He also says that it's short-lived. It's a vampire. He could do it. Not with Angelica as a repeating witch, but that you suspend the bat transformation, put in a few good wax, a stake, a hammer, and you're done. But that is that version of her. So, figuring out changing from human form to animal and then just wiping her out in the middle somewhere there. And he also says, okay, I'm going to get out of here. And at the same time, Barnabas wants to pay him something for his troubles, and he's all, no, it's just the fact that I could get payback. That's enough for me. This one's on the house, and Roger is there by now and says it certainly has been, and the bioexorcist has to inform him that it's an illusion, that he can check the drawing room, it's okay, and that, yes, Angelique has been around a few blocks, but he's been around more. But Barnabas asks him, as you say, she could come back as a witch, and he admits, yeah, when doesn't that rascal? Why do you think I'm hitting the road? Like I say, no charge. And then, because with the Jennings, werewolves are a-comin', so wolves are howling, and Beetlejuice explains, yeah, that's my cue to split. Which it is. Oh, I had a great belch at the time. I remember Tito, like, way after the fact, he's all, put some echo on that, and it's like, no, I couldn't have done that. But I left the huge belch in, thinking, yeah, that's Beetlejuice, so I'll just let it go. I'll just add it in. And then he starts to say, I don't do two shows a night. And that's where the belch came. And he says, I don't do two shows a night. And would one of you two do the honors, meaning get rid of him? Maggie knows how. And he says, ciao. You know, he leaves. And Barnabas asks Maggie, how do you know his name? Call me psychic, at least in this instance. Oh, yeah. Mrs. Johnson asking for Mr. Collins. And Roger and Barnabas ask yes. And, you know, and then she's all worried about her angel food cake, making sure that the ruckus is over, and there's a little bit of argument about that. But yeah, I always love, I mean, that's one of the reasons that I say, if anybody is interested in Dark Shadows but they don't like the Roger character, find people who do. They will very likely enjoy The Pit, because I try to get Roger down as good as possible, and more. And Roger says to Mrs. Johnson, we know how important the cake is, you know, certainly, the walls of Collinwood may split asunder as long as the cake rises. And Barnabas assures her, and then Roger just keeps going. And he would on the original show, that's why I just adored him. I do love how we can shift our concerns from the destruction of our home to the culinary needs of baking. Oh, yeah, I keep the Barnabas and Josette romance going. Maggie says, I'm not going to reprimand you. Barnabas says, oh, I was hoping you might. And she's confused by that, and he's like, I'll release a little tension. It inspires my passion when you reprimand me, Josette. Which somebody actually pointed out, oh, how better can you get than that? You know, that's as love as it gets. But that's what I saw coming out of Barnabas when it came to Josette. It's like, he was so irritated at any other foe in the way. But when it came to Josette, she could just have at him and go, and he was just happy as a lark. Yeah. It inspires my passion when you reprimand me, Josette. And in The Pit, he will call her Josette, but he's always a little cautious with it. Like he is at the beginning of the novel. He's cautious with it because he's worried it's just going to backfire on him. And then it's great as the scenes progress. Lily Munster and Elizabeth Stoddard come in. And this is the big, everyone is coming together for the goodbye scene. You know, kind of a big goodbye scene. But at the same time, I have a hard time visualizing the new Lily Munster. You know, the Yvonne DiCarlo, more mundane looking Lily. Because at this point, she pretty much is that. but still being Lily Munster. And then it was great because Mrs. Stoddard is asked if she'd noticed anything. Well, we just see lightning coming from inside the house rather than outside of it. And there's some dropping of the Caleb stuff. And then Barnabas admits that Caleb arranged for me to engage with a bioexorcist to diminish that lady you mentioned, Cousin Lily. I can't say I'm disappointed at the results, but the interim was most disturbing. Uncle Caleb arranged, Lily asks. And that's the thing, is that as much as Barnabas is, you know, he begins to get blamed, but it's recognized, hey, this Caleb suggested this. We went to Uncle Caleb to ask him for his advice. He said do this. We did it. And it got super scary and super bad, but it's all over now, so don't worry about it, you know. But I think it was also good in reflection of Dark Shadows, because, yeah, everybody comes to Barnabas, oh, it's you, and it's like, no, actually it isn't. He's taking a lot of advice that he didn't come up with this. He's just following orders in a certain respect. Then what's great is Lily Munster, and I'm sure now that it's all worked out, Uncle Caleb is having a grand laugh over the whole thing, and Barnabas admits, no doubt. So there's so much, again, in this. These things are packed. Do not binge the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows radio drama. Do not. And then David's worried. Roger's happy that David's worried, because at least he gives a darn. So David's worried about Elizabeth leaving. And then they get kind of wrapped up with, oh yeah, there was these weird sounds, and Lily noticed the weird sounds, but she says they were pleasant, you know, it'll be a shame mishearing more of it. Collinwood is feeling so much like home now, because there's like howling outside. And we always go back, you know, I was talking to Sheen about this recently, where I'm not sure when it comes to Lily Munster and Elizabeth Stoddard being cousins and hanging out, you just don't know of the comedy duo which one is the straight man, quote unquote. Which one's the goofball and the straight, you know, because that's how comedy duos work. But that's kind of how they run, where, you know, Lily's saying one thing, Elizabeth's just kind of shrugging it off, or Elizabeth's saying one thing and Lily's shrugging it off because it's the mundane versus the spooky and you're not sure which is which. But when they hear the howling, Lily is like, oh, I thought it was my brother Lester. If anybody remembers the Munsters, there was the brother Lester. He was a werewolf too, which I guess is why it makes sense that Eddie was a monster. You know, this child, this vampire woman gives birth to. Yeah. And that's why I was, you know, telling a friend recently, that's why when I would see this critiquing that, oh my gosh, you know, I didn't know how programmed it was. And I'm like, I am blaming, you know, like the marriage novel, I'm blaming the vampirism on Lily Munster. How this woman is able to walk around in the day, be a vampire, walk around in the day, and give birth to little Eddie is beyond me. But they did it in the 60s on TV, so whatever. You know, nobody was willing to actually get in touch to do anything different. So I was like, whatever. And I'm kind of proud of myself that I just was like, shrug. Like, I don't know what's wrong with everyone. I'm just going to throw another curveball and make a joke. I can't deal with this, you know, that taking this crap seriously. It's fiction, for God's sake. You know, there's some rules that you sort of have to follow, but there's other ones where it's like, no, it's fiction. Why do you care? Why are you even talking? How come the people who enjoy this aren't saying more? And yeah, and I figured it out later, of course, but so there's more about Lester and because werewolves are coming. So Lester was a good focal point. And Elizabeth asks, Lily, didn't you say he was more of the family vagrant? Lily says gutter pup would be the more accurate description. And why would you want to hear from him? And they keep on going. And finally, Roger gets impatient. Must we go on and on about Cousin Lester? And it's just wonderful because Roger Collins from the old show Dark Shadows is talking about some dude who was briefly on the Munsters as a cousin, werewolf cousin. It's just beautiful. I don't know, there's something about that that it just, yeah, just mix it all up. And especially when I, you know, see what poor Quentin was going through, what Chris goes through, and I'm just thinking, brother Lester, he's in there somewhere. Oh, more so Quentin, because you see Quentin as a werewolf sometimes, and he's got all the duds. He's got the vest, he's got the pocket watch, you know, he's got all the duds. You might as well be freaking Lester Munster. Or whatever the last name would be, but I guess everybody's on there is called the Munster. Well, I guess it's supposed to be Herman's actual name, but there's also Dracula and all that. But, I mean, it should be, when you see some of the ways of Quentin as a werewolf, the way he's dressed up, you think Lester from the Munsters. Because I think it's very similar. The waistcoat and the pocket watch and the pants and just all those things. And, of course, Quentin wakes up looking like Captain Kirk, you know, with a ripped shirt and everything. But for a little while, every once in a while, he's dressed up pretty good as a werewolf. Oh, and then the wonderful bit. Roger asserts that Elizabeth is getting out of the house, going on a journey. It's been high time, and Elizabeth is teasing him, and you'll have the decanters all to yourself, Roger. Won't that be marvelous? And Roger admits, yes, it will be. Exhilaratingly. I always forget some of the ways that I put parentheses on these lines. Oh, and then Oisin helped me with this, where it's like, where are the tickets coming from? Who's in charge of figuring stuff out for the call? And says, Roger hands over the tickets and says, courtesy of Richard Garner. So that's good. You know, that's another little piece of trivia. And then about bloody time, Lily says, don't mention blood. And then the buffet dinner, and that Lily is looking forward to dancing. I really don't recall whether Lily was much of a dancer on the Munsters, but I'm just going with whatever. I don't even know, like, with Endora and that dance thing with Captain Greg. You know, maybe Endora hates dancing on Bewitched in an episode or two, and maybe another episode she loves it. I don't know. So, just doing my best here. And fond farewells. And Carolyn is teary and emotional. And everyone is culminating a goodbye, and Carolyn's saying that she's going to miss Elizabeth dreadfully, because there's something at the back of her mind where it's like, this is the last moment, and I really can't ask, because she's got to get out of the door. She can't explain what I'm concerned about, Carolyn is thinking. But it's got to be there. And of course, the music is also there. And I wanted it to be a somewhat lengthy farewell, because it's a big deal. Elizabeth Collins going to England. Big deal, I would think. Barnabas, what would we do without you? And Mrs. Johnson just sort of comes out of the blue. There's no opening of a door or closing a door or whatever. It's just, let the women leave, for heaven's sake. Ship is going to wait for them. So that was just sort of random. Then David's ready to go get something to eat because it's been a long night. That's when Carolyn starts breaking down. I have a sister, you know, and Maggie's worried about her. Everybody's worried about her. It's like, I overheard them talking. This trip isn't a joyride or an excuse to visit England. I have a sister, and she didn't tell me. Because I figured at some point, yeah, Carolyn would be perturbed by that, and she's not getting all the information. And I think in 18 is when we sort of addressed that with Mrs. Muir. But yeah, she's pretty upset about it here, because whether or not it's Victoria Winters, she's got a sister, and she wasn't told. And Maggie wonders, well, wouldn't it matter if it was Victoria? And Carolyn says, yes, when she came here, it was like we were already sisters. And there's stuff from the first year where you notice, yeah, they get along exceptionally well. And that is one of the things I love about the series, is that, yeah, Carolyn and Victoria, they hit it off pretty well. And I tried to make sure that I addressed that there was that in this series that I'm creating. But yeah, they joked about, you know, fights at the Blue Whale, and oh gosh, I love that bit. I can't remember what episode of Dark Shadows it is, but when the percolator's going for the coffee, and I think it's, yeah, Victoria's standing there, and Carolyn says, if you stare at it, you think it'll, like, go faster, it'll, like, brew faster, or something like that. It was a great line. Just those little things. And also with Laura, as bad a cookie as she is, with Laura, Victoria had fondness towards Laura, and Carolyn had fondness towards Laura. Now, with the whole Burke stuff, I mean, you know, it just all kind of goes downhill. But with Victoria and Laura and Carolyn and Laura, there's some kindness, there's some fondness going on before everything kind of goes downhill. And those are pretty neat little bits. And Carolyn gets what she needs, and Roger's gonna comfort her in the drawing room. Calls her kitten a few times, which is good. Or maybe just a couple times. The next scene is part of the Sam and Maggie Solve It show. Actually, the reactions to those scenes. Hidden Object mentioned three highlights. People's reactions. Roger going for the insurance papers. David going for the stamp collection. Excellent sound effects. Very thankful I hadn't just ate. Yeah, because I think I put a warning, like, don't eat anything before this because of the projectile vomiting stuff. How are you able to speak after doing BJ's voice? Great job. Loved Mrs. Johnson's. Keep it down in there. Door slam. And Helena, a bioexorcist, comes to Colin Wood. Great title, Beetlejuice and Vangelique. What was he thinking? Has everyone gotten to her ahead of me? That was good. And yes, Milligan, in this case, unless you can win her over before anyone else, everyone has gotten to her before you. What if Angelique was a Vulcan? Spock would have been depressed for the rest of his years. I think she would have been a whole lot worse than Spock's former bride, T'Pring, or as I like to call her, T'Pringles, from a Star Trek fandom I created in my mind but never put down on paper or computer screen. Yeah, I love the intro music to the scene. Nice touch. Also love Beetlejuice's voice. That's a great take on his speech, if that's a good way to say it. Did you have an image of Angelique's eyes bulging at the sight of Beetlejuice's entrance? I did. Will Beetlejuice run amok of the Collins family afterwards? I'm tuning in to see. David scurried like a cat up those stairs for his stamp collection, laugh out loud. Well, Barnabas, I think the previous relationship between BJ and Angelique, or Vangelique, was horrible for her. Oh, he forced a slimy kiss on her. Ew. Oh, the vomit projectiles. Great work on the sound effects, Daryl. And I caught the nod from the DS movie on BJ missing her first aim at Evangelique. Ha, Beetlejuice skipped out on a potential match with a werewolf. I can't believe that Mrs. Johnson missed out on a not-so-ordinary paranormal battle. Maybe that's how she copes with the house. Instead of concentrating on the haunts, let's concentrate on baking angel food cakes, everybody. Maybe it's just me, but Mrs. Johnson is better than me. Also, was that a gunshot or thunder? Of course, Roger, go put back the insurance papers. Nope, Roger and the other living Collins would never cause such a ruckus. It's always the dead and undead and the Vangeliques that cause all the ruckus and dramas. Well, if you don't count David almost killing Roger like the omen child he was at one point, if you shave his head, you may see a faded 666 tattoo on his scalp. Just saying. Oh, what sweet ending between Barnabas and Maggie. Oh, Josette. You know, honestly, I thought that Liz and Lily already left for the cruise. My bad. Liz is still prudish over public displays of affection by Barnabas and Maggie, but I guess maybe once she meets up with Leslie again, she'll loosen up a little more. If Beetlejuice didn't run from Chris the werewolf, he would have brought down the whole estate. Nodding, Roger is clueless. He should recognize that his son wanted his aunt to stay. Curiosity killed the cat. That's a fitting line for Roger. Having unlimited alcohol is a dream. Ha, Lily's got a hankering for blood at the very mention of it. I wonder, will the rest of the monsters, including Lester, drop by? Yeah, trying to figure out all the stuff with Carolyn. Why weren't they asking the same question as she was, especially Roger? I would think that he would be in an uproar about why he's finding out about having another niece after over 20 years, and we get to that, I think, in 18 or 19. Unless he knew all along and Liz was unaware of his knowledge. Are you going for that angle? I don't know. I can't remember. Back to the Sam and Maggie solve it portion of the show. And we go back to first-year trivia, because it was like Sam, you know, notices that Maggie's home. Going to spend a few nights getting settled into that spooky old joint no one could pay you to work in. Yes, Maggie says, for $100 a day. No, that was something that Maggie had told Victoria in that, maybe even the first episode. Couldn't pay me $100 a day to work in that place. Oh, and then more pit stuff. It's like, Sam asks, looks like Collinwood is surprising as ever. From how you appear, is Wadsworth lingerie lying around at the Grey House too? Because he was there when they found that in episode 14. He was at the old house. So he's wondering if the lingerie is hanging around the Grey House. It's like, oh, Pop, you never fail to put a light heart on all this turbulence. Then he asserts, well, we were once related to the French nobility, Josette. So going back and forth between being Sam and Maggie and being Andre and Josette. Wrong side of the tracks, peasant foundations. I have to allow for some bowing to the absurd, and I'm sure you do more so. And Maggie says, but that doesn't stop the jolting effect it has when it comes. And he admits, of course not. So I'm going to talk about it. She starts to say Papa and then Pop, and it's like, hey, juggle the nicknames, it's okay. They go over Caleb, and Sam's memory of knowing about him is, yeah, some Victoria-era gentleman. What a crank. And she says, mm-hmm. So I went to stow some extra things in Victoria's room, because that's where she's going to stay as the governess of Collinwood. And Sam points out the one that used to be yours anyway. So that was Josette's room, and Victoria got it later, and then she moved out, etc., etc. Maggie's moving into it. Interesting. But Maggie mentions, yeah, just to see it again, because in this version of Dark Shadows, she has those memories. So she's going into the room as Maggie Evans and as Josette Dupré. Can't remember if Kitty ever went there, but hey. And Sam asks, no music box. No, and Barnabas has promised me I won't see it until I want to. And Sam says, good. We've had enough of that tinkling. And then they focus on that for a minute because he wants to know if she remembers the first time it was given to her rather than during the kidnapping time where it was sort of, hey, look at this, and identify with it. Whereas when Josette saw it, I mean, she was just enamored. She was entranced when Barnabas showed it to her in the 1790s. But Maggie's dealing with trying to remember, you know, trying to find that memory as Josette, but also having these messed up kidnapping memories of it too, where it's like, hey, wait till I remember it as the full girl rather than the tweaked out girl when you were tweaked out kind of thing. then the percolator finishes, they get the coffee. But yeah, I mean, Maggie's dealing with, hey, that memory of the music box is too wrapped up in the kidnapping, so I need to deal with that later. But at the same time, she still has fond memories sort of lingering in the distance as Josette. And due to some stuff that Maggie's suspecting, she's asking if Captain Greg reminded Sam of some things, entities that lurk in the shadows. And he says, not much, I dare say. But he's still trying to digest his own personal experiences. It's very much like Sarah Collins' ghost and her own ambiguity. You can't always put your darn finger on what you know and what you don't know, and that's the issue with dealing with past lives, whether it's somebody who's claiming to do so or in fiction. And Maggie notices, that's true, poor Barnabas, always so uncertain about me. No matter what I do to reassure him that it is me, he has so much fear that it isn't true, like it's a spell that will break at any moment, and that is what Barnabas would very likely go through. Well, is this real? You know, I've been wanting it. I've pursued it. I was kind of crazy to try and force it on somebody, and then it ends up being the very person because of reincarnation. Oh my gosh. But again, Sam, as Andre remembers, he says, Maggie, he was always like that. If there is any nervousness in him that you aren't who you obviously are, rest assured that is your proof that he is the same man you fell in love with over 100 years ago. I told him that, too. I remember talking to Oisin about this, because she said that she loved the line with Andre back in the 1790s about him being positive that Josette loved Barnabas, you know, in the pit. He says, I had no doubt in my mind about it. We were about to embark on a share of our sugarcane profits for your marriage, and I was willing to, with my knowledge of your love for Barnabas Collins on that account. I knew you loved him, and I still know it. Insecurities and all. And that is something that Andre was very persistent about. I know she loves you, you know, because the whole thing with Jeremiah, he was telling Barnabas back in the 1790s, I know she loves you. And so in the pit, he says, I still know it, you know. And Maggie relieves herself with a little laughter. All right, if he is always going to be nervous about me, at least I can take comfort in the knowledge he is Barnabas Collins and no other. At least that part of him hasn't changed. Let's see. Oh, that was the deal that Maggie's, you know, dark entity. She's thinking about Beetlejuice, and she's trying to explain that. So she's wondering if maybe Captain Gray got Sam prepared for this kind of thing. She mentions, hey, we're all expecting Barnabas to do too much and to trust him to handle it. You know, I trust him to handle it. You know, I'm the one who told him to do this. And then calamity strikes at Collinwood, and we go back to a first line thing. It wasn't even David Ford's Sam who said this. It was the previous guy. Nice, respectable house with nice, respectable horrors is what Sam refers to Collinwood as. That's how he describes it. And Maggie says about the Beetlejuice encounter, Pop, these horrors were not respectable. Oh, we are talking about the same Collinwood, aren't we? And she says, I want to say yes. And he says, well, then say it. If we weren't shocked by what goes on up at that hill, it wouldn't be Collinwood. So she tries to describe everything with the bioexorcist. The correct title is Bioexorcist. He wants revenge on Annalyn. You know, bioexorcist? I've heard of exorcist, but that sounds backwards. So she notices the difference, and he says, what happened? That basically what this entity did was he sent her to hell in a handbasket, and Sam starts laughing. Now, when we think about Happier in Hell, she is sort of going to hell in a handbasket. When we think about it. But Sam is starting to laugh. You know, it's interesting with the singing and the laughter. It's interesting trying to figure out who, you know, like, there was, I think in episode 6, trying to figure out how on earth would Barnabas laugh. I'm not sure I've ever really heard him laugh at all. So I had to do that performance a few times, trying to figure out how on earth would Barnabas laugh, having to figure out Sam would laugh. He's guffawed here and there in the Dark Shadow show. Maggie's easier. She laughs quite a bit, but trying to figure out how Sam, especially laughing at, you know, what's going on with, I mean, because he's really letting it all out. Yeah, it's been another challenge figuring out how all these characters would laugh if they had to. Whereas, you know, if it's Roger, it's just, ha! It's kind of like that. And I don't know, I'd have to go back and look over all my shows to figure out if I had more to that. But yeah, he really just, Sam lets it loose when it comes to this bioexorcist thing. And they have some coffee, and Maggie says, okay, so this crazy stuff happened, he got rid of this version of her, but Angelique always comes back, and we know that. And so it's like, all right, so what are we going to do? And then pulling out the compass for figure out, like, well, I have this compass, Captain Gray gave it to me, if I need some help. So Maggie says, not just now, but you've piqued my interest. I'd like to meet this mysterious sea captain. After all, any friend of Sarah Collins is a friend of mine. So, as of that, I have no doubt.
And so with that, Sam and Maggie stuff,
Helena was amused that better not let Wadsworth hear you, Sam, because of thinking about the Frankenfurter stuff and the lingerie.
And by sensing awkwardness between Sam and Maggie and their reincarnations, I know that Sam is cool with the switch-up, but I sense that awkwardness, like they're still getting used to discovering their past lives. Interesting perspective Sam had on their past and current stations in life. Yes, at one point they were French aristocrats, and now they're blue collars. Now they know how it is to be in both places. And then, yeah, thank goodness for a break from that damn music box.
So, the next scene is a Willie and Wadsworth scene. It begins with the sound effect of a glass pen scribbling. That is actually a glass pen that I got from a box set that I bought somewhere in one of our travels from a Victorian trading company. And so, I just made the sound effects to make it authentic that was what Willie was doing. And one pen pal actually was writing to me about an episode with a glass pen that it was her way of just something for Willie. She was using a glass pen, just as Willie was in whatever episode she was talking about. She did that on purpose, which I really appreciated. That was just such a wonderful touch to everything. And I think she used sepia in honor of Barnabas, too. So it was just very, very touching. So it's a Willie and Wadsworth scene in episode 17 here. And I felt that this had to be addressed, where as Willie is understanding Angelique, the story of her and why Barnabas became so dreadful, and he's admitting that it makes the guy more human to me, knowing about her and knowing how terrible she could be, but he's still having trouble with understanding, and I felt that it definitely had to be addressed with Willie, that he's still struggling with Maggie really being Josette after all that stuff in the kidnapping, which I'm sure was not the original plan with the Barnabas character when they put the kidnapping together. It just, over time, changed into this other story. But originally, it really was because he was the villain and there was a kidnapping and he's trying to push on this identity to this young girl who resembles his previous love life in another time period. But as the Dark Shadow's whole storyline progressed, it becomes that thing that was, you know, and we've seen it in other Dracula stories where there is a reincarnation and she re-meets the Dracula character in another life. But back then, when they started the Barnabas character, it was only going to be a matter of weeks and they were going to off him. So it transformed. So I'm dealing with that in this scene with Willie and Wadsworth where he's like, I still can't get over it. But Sarah is helping Willie to adjust to the new information, but that Willie and Maggie went through all that in the kidnapping, and how come she didn't remember actually being Josette? And Wadsworth says, well, did you notice her being a little uncertain about who she was, minus all this weight upon her to be somebody else? It's a little in question. That there were times, Willie says, Maggie would play along with the Josette idea like Barnabas wanted her to, and then there were times she seemed lost in it, trying to find herself. And Wadsworth tells Willie, precisely, that's what makes these experiences so difficult. One knows there are memories which are locked away. The lost look comes from those searching to find them, seeking out the answers, as it were. And then Willie's also, Dr. Hoffman finally used that pesky medallion for discovery instead of hiding things. And yeah, Wadsworth says Dr. Hoffman has come a long way, particularly hard with someone such as myself in her way. And Willie, knowing Wadsworth, no one can beat you, you old sauce, not even me. And Wadsworth tries to take that as a compliment. And as Willie is not convinced of Maggie, Wadsworth tells him, well, Mr. Collins isn't quite either. He harnesses so much self-doubt and disbelief in gaining extraordinary wealth outside of materialism, and he always has. And Willie knows that, too. But when they go back to Angelique, Willie says, knowing about her always reminds me to be better. That it's about manipulation, and he understands manipulation. And knowing about her makes Willie recognize how far he's changed, how far he's come. That if he had that kind of power, what destruction he could do with it, and that he just doesn't like thinking of himself as having that ability. Just all these awful things that could be possible. But Wadsworth agrees with him that he hopes that he's had a hand in giving Willie that change for the better. That gives Willie the opportunity to tell Wadsworth, I'm glad to see you again. I haven't had the chance to tell you. I'm glad you're back. I'm glad you're here. You were there for me as a kid, and in a way that made the world make sense to me. something better, something for the better, something to strive for that I lost as I grew up. So that's another thing, that when we give Willie Loomis that personal growth and that past with Wadsworth, it doesn't have to be very detailed. You don't have to go back to all these aspects in his childhood. There could be this one component, this one chance that Willie had, and then he lost it because he got caught up in other things. And then there is this butler in his life again who wants to make that difference. He's making it that difference in other people's lives. But there he is for Willie again. It can be that difference again. And Willie sees that and he knows that initially he's twisted up and he doesn't want to get caught up in, oh my gosh, this guy again. Then after a while he realizes, no, that was the nicer guy. This guy's definitely better than Jason, and a little bit better than Barnabas. But he's also working with Barnabas, so that's a good thing too. Then you get a door creak and it becomes another scene where Sarah, the ghost of Sarah Collins, walks in. That's very important. And Sarah has opinions about Wadsworth too, telling Willie about that, and Willie's asking what she's here for, and Sarah wants to know how his letters, meaning his calligraphy, is working out, and he shows Sarah that he's got a glass pen, and she's amazed, she's very interested, and he calls, very just offhandedly, that's right, Angel, you know, he just calls her an angel, but she's never seen a glass pen like that before, and that it's so pretty, and he says, just like you, and she's, oh, Willie, you know, yeah, too much. He says, I can't help it, sir. I calls him like I sees him. But she wants to know if he's been practicing. And Willie asks her, do you want to tell me that poem you to practice with? And of course we go back again to a piece of Dark Shadows trivia, that evil is wicked is well understood. The wicked are punished, so you must be good. Now that's something that Barnabas taught Sarah, and Sarah was trying to teach him back in the series. So she uses it again here in the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows with Willie, and he writes it, and you can't the scribbling. And I'm sure I've posted a picture of it somewhere online, me writing, you know, not necessarily like my hand writing it, but having it written with that glass pen set. And Willie asks, how's that? And she says, that's right. But it wouldn't hurt to write it again, Willie. And other people figured this out. Straight out of Princess Bride, Willie says, as you wish. I think quite a few listeners, the few that I know, you know, I think quite a few of the few that I know figured that out. That I was like, I think that's from Princess Bride. And it totally fits. Good job. And it was, you know, just trying to get it right. Say it how Willie would say it. And of course, it's not anything ooey. It's just platonic. So, with this scene, one pen pal is writing, the exchange between Wadsworth and Willie is nice, and Willie's writing with a glass pen. Oh, yeah, I like Sir Simon sniffling after the sentimental scene between Willie and Sarah, calling Hecubus my deficient demon, and not understanding Willie Loomis saying, as you wish, to Sarah Collins, I'm sure the double-slash-extra meaning, as per The Princess Bride, is intentional. Yes, indeed. Ah, another pen pal. Sarah and Willie are always gentle with each other. With Willie and Wadsworth, such a range of voices you do well, from meek, mild Willie to crazy as Beetlejuice. And Willie saying, knowing about her always makes me better, and about how some people handle power. True. Ah, and Warren. Wadsworth and Willie, great times, calm to the story, but using it to further the story, bringing up Hoffman's medallion, also foreshadow to Angelique's return, how far Willie has come, nice bringing in Sarah, nice poem, incantation. And another pal, oh, who just really liked everything, also the Willie-Wadsworth-Sarah scene warmed my heart. I haven't watched Dark Shadows in ages, and I shall still have a crush on Willie, even when you're performing him. Gosh, he's so cute. I agree. And I do my best with the scratchy, you know, it's like, that's as close as I could get. I remember I started as Mousy in 2013 when I really started to get going with trying to do the voice acting. But yeah, he had to be scratchy overall. And Helena, for Willie and Wadsworth, it's great that Wadsworth was a beacon of hope for Willie at one point. At least that's what I'm getting. I kind of like how Sarah added Anna sometimes when she said that she liked Wadsworth better than Riggs. Well, I don't remember Riggs except on the Lethal Weapon movies, but I remember the name. The fellow from the 1790s in DS. Sounds like that is it for that scene. And I think we go on to the two dates after that. Alright, so we've got another scene with our lovely Tony and Carolyn. And yeah, I'm very proud of this one, because we went back to Santo and Johnny, as I said, many years ago. It was a great, it's like the jukebox music at the Blue Whale, so you can add it to just about any date in this series. And yeah, I have to listen to this more closely because this is the Tony voice that I really should be shooting for, not the one from later. Ah, yeah. Listening to this one again and just focusing on the words. And yeah, there's a lot of sweet nothings in here. I'm really proud of this date scene. They are considering what happened to Tom Jennings and Elizabeth's daughter leaving on her trip. Carolyn's concerned about that. But I mean, it really is a quiet moment, at least most of it. A lot of sweet nothings, a lot of compliments from Tony Peterson, good background music, and thoughts about the sunrise that morning that they share together. And I don't know if they're driving to dinner or driving away from dinner or what they're doing exactly. They're just enjoying their time together until Carolyn notices that as Tony's paying her a lot of compliments, he needs to keep his eyes on the road. And that's when the Ooga and, yeah, you hear all the little cars in the background. The pal that I mentioned in the last show that wanted to do the Beetlejuice voice when I first contacted him, he, to my memory, provided me with the honking noise and also where I could get more sound effects for a Shriner's Parade, which didn't happen that long ago. And I was like, oh my gosh, they're still doing this. So he provided some help with that so I could get sound effects for it. And that was really nice. And so let's see if I have part of his review for the Tony and Carolyn date here. The Tom Jennings story is still a mystery. Reminds me of another good view. Smooth. Ha. Hey, it's the hot rod horn I sent ya. Oh yeah, this is kind of an in-joke. The dead Kennedys have interrupted their romance. Yeah, we remember a Shriner's picture from one of the albums of that band. And what to do while we wait? I have my ideas. You know, that's pretty much his thoughts on the Tony and Carolyn. Because, I mean, he was interested in the Tony and Carolyn romance here. Because he was saying they always get interrupted. Either somebody's walking in on them or something's happening. They're always. And I think Hidden Object 2 had also mentioned something about Tony and Carolyn for the same total that they should be called Couple Interrupted or something like that. Yeah, I get a little worried. There's another pen pal who was talking about this scene. Glad another tragedy didn't ruin the nice time for Carolyn and Tony in her mom's boat. Hasn't even moved. Well, she already misses her. Like, she's been gone a while. Smiling faces, cool song. All the times Carolyn has been someone else's, he is most happy in the moment she is next to him. He almost kills them both. Because, yeah, that's the Shriner's Parade almost knocks into him. Sweet moment came close to a death moment. I do agree with her analogy on the Shriners. They are asking for a death wish in those little cars. Fraternities is the easy answer. Laugh out loud. And yeah, another listener said, everything's going smoothly until, blam, they swerve out of control. I gasped when I heard that part because of how calm the beginning was. I just wasn't expecting that. It was nice to hear the addition of the old car horn as well. The line, so many smiling faces, reminding him of advertisements, was so creative. I was immediately able to picture that in my head. And moving out on to following scene, which is another date, not the Tony and Carolyn one. The Tony and Carolyn one basically ended with them smooching. And then you notice, you know, at a restaurant somewhat close, Dr. Hoffman's peeping through the window of a romantic eating establishment nearby. And Stokes is wondering, what do you see, Julia? And this is the part I had mentioned in the pseudo-retrospective for season 2. She says, oh, looks like Mr. Peterson managed to avoid a crash with the Shriners Parade going on. I must say Dr. Pierce, meaning Hawkeye, picked the better convention to attend. Because obviously this one's going up the creek. They discuss a little bit of what's going on with Dr. Pierce and his friend and, you know, why they would be so flamboyant humorously and that kind of thing in such a situation. And Begin to Begin. So, you know, like I've already got that Dave Clark 5 song in the previous episode. This one, I was like, yeah, we gotta have the date, you know, first date that I can even be aware of in Dark Shadows fanfiction for Dr. Hoffman and Professor Toakes. Begin to Begin. So, gotta put that in there. And then another one, they've got the Shirelles, but not this episode. This is Begin to Begin. That's their love song. And, like a good chap, like a wonderful romantic partner, he has interest in what her day was like. He told her that Wycliffe had missed her. And she talks about Amy Jennings admitting her into the asylum, Tom Jennings, because of his passing and Amy and all that. So they're talking about that already, which is what's going on in Dark Shadows. And that's one of the reasons that'll relief series a wonderful thing to do if you can swing it, because if you're just solving all these problems and you're trying to work romances out too, well, what do the romances have to talk about? The next thing coming up. I mean, there it is, and that's my plans for Carolyn and Tony too. It's nice to have these couples happy and in situations where they're getting to know each other better and spending time together, but the conversation can always go back to what is coming next in the original material. And if you're doing a relief series, that's one of the best things to do. What is next? What's next to solve, or what's next to deal with, or what's next to focus on? And that also leaves Dr. Hoffman and Professor Stokes open to discussing who is hard not to discuss, Barnabas Collins, and is he a vampire or is he not, blah blah blah. We could have gone on any other topic, but Barnabas is always the easiest one, isn't it? Oh, and he gets a little close and tender too. Allow me a smile at your blush. I would prefer to induce that with my own affectionate attentions, says Professor Stokes. He also asks about Barnabas. He was a mortal man from the start, was he not? Yes, our Mr. Collins wasn't a vampire, and then he was, and now he sort of isn't. Which reminded me, you know, like it's kind of going back to the Zen Koan. Julia, what is this Barnabas Collins? Asked Professor Stokes. A Zen Koan? First there was a mountain, then there wasn't, then there was? And at the time, you know, and Hoffman says, you're thinking of a popular song, which is based on the translation, says Professor Stokes, of thoughts in Buddhism about the state of understanding the world. But let us digress. So then Stokes, you know, we're getting close because the Jennings are already coming into place, so we can just move on to the next topic, which is what happens, you know, after the fight scene. Beetlejuice leaves because he hears a werewolf howling. And we get to Stokes and Hoffman's date. At the end of it, Stokes mentions, one element that fascinates me is the similar affliction, not vampirism, but lycanthropy. Oh? Asks Hoffman. Werewolves? Precisely. How do you feel about that subject, Doctor? And in true date form, she says in a sultry way, Professor, if there's a goodnight kiss into the bargain, I'll talk to you about anything. They don't kiss in this episode, but they are on a date. They've already kissed in the previous episode. They're going to kiss in another one coming along pretty soon. Ah, heavens. It's so little dialogue, or at least the chunk is... Wait, let's go back a step, because I want to look at what the reviews were. Okay, so the discussion for that date scene. Ah, ha, ha. Hidden Object said, I found it interesting that a romantic dinner for Hoffman and Stokes... involved talk of vampires, past lives, etc. Look forward to seeing this pair again. Exactly. Some stuff Elena added to that. I like how you intertwine the last scene, meaning Carolyn and Tony's date, with currently by having Julia to witness the near accident of Tony and Carolyn with the Shriners. Stokes trying to pry into Barnabas' secret. I thought he knew about Barnabas' vampirism? Oh, never mind. He knew. I caught on to him being glad that Barnabas is just a friend. No competition, you know. And yeah, that was something in the scene that Stokes is proud for being able to do that. But Dr. Hoffman says, I do have the ability to recognize the true nature of relationships in my profession, T. Elliot Stokes. And he says, I always knew that you did, Dr. Julia Hoffman. Truths in these matters where I'm concerned weren't always so forthcoming. Yeah, like a lot of truths and matters on Collins Board are not forthcoming, but it's good practice to, you know, recognize, hey, yeah, she knows what she's doing, she knows what's romantic and what isn't, and that's why some of us really like Dr. Hoffman, because she's a doctor first and foremost. Oh, and Helena adds, you know, usually on a date, we would not be talking about Barnabas or Amy Jennings, but then again, you did imply that this could have been their first ever date. I'm going to need them to stop beating around the bush and get down to business. Talk about yourselves, your dreams, your weird tales, or sex, even in a clinical manner. Oh, a promise of a good night kiss? Goody. Hands rubbing together. Thanks for the romantic background music. I am looking forward to more romance from our professional couple. So then we move on. There was a lot of studying just to try to figure out how to make this historically accurate, and it's probably still not all the best of jobs. But most of what Oshin and I discuss to get it historically accurate is what Hecubus and Milligan are saying to each other before the boat sing. So they went by train first, and the thrill of cramped traveling can make people very friendly indeed. And then staying in New York, arriving in a Grand New York train station, being central, meaning Grand Central or otherwise, because I wasn't sure. Our fair ladies enjoyed a two-night stay at their NYC hotel, something famous and ritzy, no doubt. So, yeah. Spending their time in whatever fun-loving way was possible, considering how distracting such a city is by itself, they were eventually whisked toward the west side of Manhattan by taxi to their ocean liner docks, and then boarded the RMS Queen Elizabeth. Now, initially, I had thought the QE2. I consulted Oisin years ago about this, and she said, well, you know, I think the QE2 wasn't in operation yet by that time. So, and then she sends me this big old picture of the RMS Queen Elizabeth the first one, not the QE2, the QE1. But it wasn't really called the QE1, to my knowledge. It was the RMS Queen Elizabeth, whose official ship, you know, and so it was like, okay, we'll go with that one, and maybe the gang will come home on the QE2, who knows? So that was the awesomeness of that, and it's, I think a lot of people have felt it was just very fitting that Elizabeth Stoddard is going to go to England on a boat named Queen Elizabeth. But it's just, yeah, what more perfect can you get, whether it's the QE2 or the RMS Queen Elizabeth, okay. And Hecubus asks, are you sure that is historically accurate, Master? Milligan answers, no, and anyone who has a problem with it should have contacted us sooner, so there. And that's the thing about this. It's like, all right, the internet was supposed to, you know, help us with all these things. And yeah, this fan work and a show and a podcast, that seems kind of minor, but you'd think everybody would have a lot of time on their hands with all the time we've been quote-unquote saving. Well, no, actually, we've been wasting more time. Because of the business incentive, so, you know, it's all screwed up. Alas and alack. You know, and then people coming along to criticize up the wazoo, even though they love what I'm doing, and but all they know is to criticize, and I'm thinking rude or crazy or whatever, and now I find out that it's much more complicated than that, and there's just a surge of, all anybody knows how to do is nitpick flaws, because they've been sitting there nitpicking flaws on a conveyor belt for 10 years. So, it's like, oh, man. You notice how I sound a lot less bitter about that? It's like you learn what the problem was, and you go, well, that stinks, but here we go, you know, that's it. I mean, it's, you know, just hoping everybody else heals from this nonsense. But in any case, that is the problem, and that has been the problem. So, in order to get stuff like this done, all you get is do it over, or it's not good enough, and you're just like, I'm doing this for free, and I'm, you know, working my butt off, and no thank you for your advice, I know, but I want to keep going, get it finished, and live my life. There's no reason to keep doing the same one episode a zillion times and never get it right because nobody's happy because they're too busy nitpicking flaws. It's just not any way to exist. In any case, Milligan and Hecubus discuss how they get to the boat, and then thankfully they get to the darn boat, and they're on the cruise liner, and the RMS Queen Elizabeth, and enjoying some punch. In a ballroom on the RMS Queen Elizabeth, Lily Munster and Elizabeth Collins Stoddard. Lily takes credit for getting rid of nuisances that they crossed upon their way, and Elizabeth is, yes, you did, my dear cousin, and jump in the line, because we already had Beatles just at the beginning, you know, the big fight scene, so I figured it's gonna be good, and I looked into this, Jump in the Line was the kind of song that people of Lily and Elizabeth's time period, the 40s or the 60s, they would have loved it. So I was like, I'm not sure if Lily Munster would have really loved this, but it's very possible. There was musical performances on the Munsters, at least in one episode. So, yeah, she could say, I love this number and want to dance with her cousin. And it's like, well, we don't have partners. No, we're each other's partner. Come on, Lizzie. She's always just chilling her cousin out, getting her going. So Elizabeth admits, okay, I'm moving. And Lily assures her that it's all right. They can shake hips. And this is the part where, you know, I'm trying to squish Bill Malloy's ghost in. So it sounds like maybe he's going to cut in or maybe they could hear him, but it's more like we're pulling back and you, in your mind's eye, see him, in my mind's eye, see him from afar, maybe looking through one of those round windows. I don't know. But I feel like this is one of the reasons that I never got Oisin's take on this episode because I just did this so poorly, but it was a rush job. It was a super rush job. There's nothing we can do about it now, but, you know, working my butt off to get Bill in there, Bill's ghost in there, and he says, every year that went by, Liz, every year, you hope the ghosts would be pushed further and further back till they were hidden so deep they don't matter no more, but a ghost won't die, and this ghost, meaning Bill Malloy's ghost, is here to revisit the greatest woman on the face of this earth. So I'm pretty sure Oisin helped me with the lines of that. So the music grows louder for a moment as Bill Malloy appreciative watches the dancing. Now that's written. You can't really hear it. And it's been too long since you were happy enough to dance, Liz. It's been far too long since you and I danced together. You know, I think it's just about time for me to cut in. Now that's more of a metaphor for what will come up later in The Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows with Bill Moyes Goes. Like, he's gonna eventually talk to Elizabeth Stoddard again. But meanwhile, Lily and Elizabeth are dancing, and Elizabeth is saying more to Lily, yes, it's wonderful. And Lily says, yes, we are. Yes, we absolutely are. Elizabeth thanks her, and the music swells, the dancing ensues, and Lily, gratefully, Elizabeth, thank you for inviting me. And Elizabeth, warmly, you're welcome, Lily. You are very welcome. And then I put in the lyrics. So, do we have some thoughts on that from listeners? Ah, Bill's ghost does enjoy seeing Liz finally enjoying the dancing since the dance of their days, and he's going to cut in. Glad the ladies are enjoying themselves, says one listener. Oh, Helena says, finally, the ending was endearing as Lily and Liz enjoy themselves. To Harry Belafonte, looking forward to the next. As always. Actually, yeah, somebody said, going back a piece, are you sure that's historically accurate? No, and anyone with a problem about it should have contacted us sooner. I like the compressed travel and details to get on to the Queen E. I'm moving. Yeah, that's how I dance. People expect more than just movement, though, oddly. Now I'm going to have Calypso in my head for the next couple hours. There are worse fates. That's good. And another one, let's see. I was surprised but amused by Lily's forcefulness regarding those chosen to convey the two and their luggage. And since my impression of Elizabeth is that of a fairly serious individual, it was nice to hear that she was entertained by Lily's antics. I join you, Lily, in your love for Jump in the Line. I was compelled to start dancing myself. Oh, and the pen pal who agreed with me about Josette being the actual Time Lord and, you know, the Jean and Lionel stuff and... Don't binge the pint. Good idea. She was saying about this scene, I like the thought of Elizabeth traveling on the RMS Queen Elizabeth. My mental image of Elizabeth Collins Stoddard with her enormous hairdo dancing to Calypso is fabulous. Excellent use of the ship's horn at the end of the episode, by the way. And yeah, oh, I'm so glad that somebody noticed that, because I was really working with that, because I was like jumping the line and trying to figure out what the two cousins are going to say to each other, and just all of these thoughts that compel them onward, these old memories from the 40s going on another trip together, now 20 years later at least, and then you hear the ocean, and I found the horn noise, and then the all due respect list, which I want to go through the all due respect list now that I got y'all here. You can turn me off anytime you want to. I've told you that before. So, all due respect to The Kids in the Hall, Clue, 1980s film, meaning Clue the movie, Beetlejuice, 1980s film, Harry Belafonte, because that's the music, The Munsters, that's where Lily Munster comes from. We mentioned Dr. Hawkeye Pierce, so MASH gets included too. Now, and then, also all due respect to Shriners International, unless there is any objection, I have never heard one since I released this episode. So, I am happy about that. The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, 1960s TV show, and of course, Dark Shadows, 1960s TV show and 2012 film. I'm persistent about that because some of that fight scene with Beetlejuice and Angelique was inspired by the 2012 film anyway. And Beetlejuice is also a Tim Burton thing. So, but yeah, you know, and at the end of that episode, just about every script I put out there, just trying to give people a way of saying thank you. If you don't know what you say how you like, you could use a line from The Golden Girls that Sophia Petrillo said, I laughed so hard I peed, and then I laughed at that. Or you could go for what Cousin Lily's final line in this episode is to her cousin Elizabeth. That would do nicely, which she says, thank you for inviting me. I don't think I've ever had anybody leave a review like that. But I did have somebody years ago leave something very close, which is, I'm so happy that you did this. There's so much I couldn't say anything, but I agree with you that Jason McGuire was the worst. I think that is the closest I've ever gotten to the heartiest thank you in the review boxes. So I thanked her. I tried to start a dialogue. She didn't respond, but, you know, they're just very good. I agree. I agree with you. You know, his/was the worst. Wow. For episode 17 in The Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows, a bioexorcist comes to Collinwood.
Script built over 2 years since 2015 and posted on the 29th of June 2018. That is a big gap. So, audio completed and uploaded on the 29th of June 2018. Wow. So, yeah. Episode 16 took a long time. This one took a lot longer, especially, you know, just trying to figure out. Because everybody wanted that fight scene, but there were so many more good things to this episode. Dance, and oh, yeah, even the cover. I love, like, Milligan sticking his fist in the air. Just a lot of good ideas. And the glamour shots of Yvonne DiCarlo and Joan Bennett that I put together like that. Yeah. A lot of good stuff. Good dough. Wadsworth and Willie scene. Good stuff with Carolyn. Gosh. Yeah, and Tony and Carolyn. And Hoffman and Stokes first date. Yeah. A lot of good stuff. Them getting out on the boat. I was not able to get to a retrospective until June of 2023 for the whole thing. Because we've all been going through the cuckoo. And hopefully you've been educated enough to understand what the cuckoo is and the big tech and the persuasive technology and the surveillance stuff and the TV. Once upon a time, we all watched it. It didn't watch us back, but now it watches us back. And that's a lot of surveillance tech going on. But the best way to protect yourself from that is to do surveillance on yourself and keep track of yourself and journal and listen to your own recordings of yourself and get to know yourself a whole lot better than anyone else can. That is the best defense. And, yeah, I'm not sure what else to say. Hopefully we're on the ball together and the anti-fans have left the building, quote-unquote. Or metaphorically left the building. Yeah, I can only imagine when you hear the word anti-fan and go and look it up and it's all those crazy people that you decided were never going to be you or were nothing you could ever be, and then you find out, gosh, in this little way, I was a very, very big anti-fan trying to get approval from a whole lot of other anti-fans, and wow, what a waste of time. It all reminds me of public school in a lot of ways, and hopefully everybody's moving on or learning to move on. I did my best with the advice that I got that seemed really good at the time, but was very bad in retrospect, and I'm happy that I made the decisions that I did to get it, just as Oisin likes to say, the hell out of Dodge. So hopefully you have enjoyed this retrospective for episode 17. Maybe I'll start more retrospectives on the marriage novel. Maybe I'll just keep going on with the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows retrospectives. Maybe I'll build a new episode. Who knows? The main thing is that I hope you all are doing well. I hope the pen pals keep in touch. I hope the friends keep in touch. Like I've said in a previous show, if you have my phone number and get in touch, that's the easiest way to get in touch right now. And you know how to use an answer machine and all of that. Or you can use what is now called the old-fashioned method of email if you know how to do letter form. My email address is xoisky. @hotmail.com. Again, xoisky@hotmail.com. And if you are up for chatting narrative or just to say how much you love whatever you are a fan of, yeah, I am interested. I hope you're all doing very well, and I hope that I continue to improve and that I hear from you. So, have a wonderful week, and take care.